Ben Franklin is supposed to have said, "I wake up every morning at 9 and grab for the morning paper. Then I look at the obituary page. If my name is not on it, I get up." I found that quote on the internet in a list of other quotes about getting up in the morning. I'm never sure if I should trust what I read on the internet. In that list was included one supposedly said by Henry David Thoreau: "There is no snooze button on a cat who wants breakfast." There were no snooze buttons back then. So, one answer to that question, what gets you up in the morning, is the process or the device. The sun, the alarm clock, a child, a partner, a pet, a need to go to the bathroom. But I don't think that answer really does the question justice, does it? The question, what gets you up in the morning, is fundamentally a question about desire. And one can go through their whole life without knowing the answer to that question. Routine too easily takes over our lives. Something is wrong when the alarm clock really is the primary thing that pushes us into the day. If we only think so far as to what is the actual thing or person that wakes us up, we miss out on an opportunity to deepen ourselves and our understanding of who we are in this world. Have you had the experience yourself, or perhaps seen it in children? Each day you have to get up for work, or the children have to get up for school. Each day is a struggle. You drag yourself out of bed, groaning and moping and wishing that you did not have to get out of that very nice, warm, cozy bed, especially on a gray morning like this morning. You manage to get dressed. The kids manage to find their shoes. Goodbyes are said, and the day is started. But each step feels like you are fighting gravity. But when vacation comes, you wake up with a smile on your face, and the children bounce out of bed at 6:30. All is right with the world. What we focus on, what we are looking forward to, has a lot to do with how we experience life. Think about it. Sleep and wake are powerful metaphors. We talk about being asleep as being unaware. I kind of spaced out. I slept through that one. I must have been asleep at the wheel. Dr. Martin Luther King gave the Ware Lecture at the UUA General Assembly entitled, "Don't Sleep Through the Revolution." Doctors and researchers do not know exactly why we sleep. Research seems to indicate that sleep is a time when we regenerate muscles, we clean out our memory a bit, we clean out our brain a bit. One doctor was quoted as saying, "You can think of it as like having a house party. You can either entertain the guests or clean the house, but you can't do both at the same time." Sleep is so common that often we don't think about it, but really looked at from an evolutionary standpoint, it is really odd. If the fittest and strongest survive, then it is to one's advantage to be aware and alert and ready to defend oneself and one's gene pool. We are wired in our DNA, handed down to us from ancestors unknown, to be hyper-vigilant, to twitch at strange noises and make sure that the lion does not surprise us out on the savannah. And in the midst of that hypervigilance, we sleep for something like 8 hours a day, and often in one long shift if we are lucky. For 8 hours a day, we are quite vulnerable to any number of dangerous intrusions. Clearly, sleep must be very necessary. But waking is also a powerful metaphor. In religious writings, one often reads of a conversion experience that woke someone up. It was if someone flipped a switch, and there I was awake, and I just knew. The Black Lives Matter movement asks us the question, "Are you woke?" Urges us to stay woke. In this instance, woke meaning aware. Sleep is powerful. When you need sleep, you need sleep. Once in my first pregnancy, I literally fell asleep mid-sentence when I was talking to someone. I laugh about it now, but I was mortified by it then. And that transition from sleep to awake is also powerful. Have you ever had this experience? You are at a point in your life when something terrible has happened to you, someone you love has died, you're dealing with a horrible diagnosis, you lost your job, your relationship broke up, something. And when you wake, there is this few seconds where that horrible weight on you just does not exist. For some of us, it takes more to move us from sleep to awake. In my family, we refer to that as bed gravity. And there are days when the bed gravity is really strong. But something wakes us up each morning. Something moves us along at whatever speed we move, some more quickly than others. James Nelson, in his book entitled God Thirst and Alcoholic Thirst, writes, "A haunting sense of incompleteness, a yearning for completion, an uncertainty craving for certainty, a brokenness hungering for wholeness. These things seem to lie at the bottom of our human spirituality. Human beings, as Karen Armstrong says, are compelled to search for hidden meaning and to achieve an ecstasy that makes them feel fully alive. Hence, desire is the core of our spirituality, a burning desire for that which promises to bring us closer to completion and certainty and wholeness, a deep desire to connect with what is most life-giving. As Plato said, we are fired into life with a madness that comes from the gods and which would have us believe that we can have a great love, perpetuate our own seed, and contemplate the divine." Dr. Nelson wrote this book as a reflection on his own addiction to alcohol and the process that he lived in staying sober, or in remission, as he called it. This book was mostly a theological reflection on addiction. And for most folks, it is clear that the path to sobriety is a spiritual one. Nelson makes the distinction between spirituality and religion. He says, our spirituality is our response to our human sense of incompleteness, whatever form that response might take. Religion, on the other hand, is the communal expression of that response. When persons bound together by similar spiritualities develop group patterns of nurturing, expressing, extending, and preserving those experiences. And he goes on to say something that I found really intriguing. What is typically missing from our common awareness, however, is the recognition that addiction, no less than recovery, is a spiritual matter. He maintains that we are all on some kind of spiritual search. We are all compelled to look for meaning. The addict is no different than the person who chooses meditation, yoga, or fasting. If the core of spirituality is looking for meaning, then really we are all on a spiritual journey. Nelson maintains, and I think there is a lot of wisdom in this, that the addict has simply chosen the wrong path. Wrong in the sense that ultimately it does not do what the addict thought it would do. It does not make meaning. It does not help to find the sacred. It is as if the addict has simply taken a wrong turn. Addicted or not, we are not all that far away from the addict that Nelson describes. Each day, each of us makes a decision to get up, and something gets us up. We each shape our lives around something. We each let something draw us on. And what is that thing? I know people for whom it is competition. Actually, it's the winning. They just want to win. They get up every morning, they want to be in that game, and they want to win the fight. Some folks I know, instead of making meaning, attempt to fill the hole by getting more stuff. And there is very little in our larger culture that would contradict this choice. Other folks want to be the most popular, have the most friends, the most degrees. Some folks find their meaning in being busy. I have an acquaintance, I promise you, not someone in this church, not even someone who goes to a church, who I actually would like to get to know better. She's a very interesting person. But every time I see her, she tells me how extraordinarily busy she is. I get tired just listening to her. And then I get anxious about my own to-do list, and perhaps I shouldn't be sitting still. What you choose as your thing to get you up in the morning will shape you. It will create you. It will grow you, but it also has the potential to break you, or maybe shape you in a way that you did not expect. And even if you don't make a choice, that will shape you too, like our character in the story this morning. Not deciding is also a decision. I do struggle with Nelson's idea that we all long to be completed, that we struggle with incompleteness. Not because I disagree with it, but in the way he frames it. I see it in my own life, and I see it in the life of others around me, so I know that it is true. Human beings are restless and never quite satisfied. Where I struggle with this is that there still is, at least in myself, if not the larger society, a negative judgment about being incomplete. If I am incomplete, there is this value out there that I must complete myself. I must fix myself. But if we are all incomplete, then isn't that simply the human condition? But what if that isn't quite true? What if the spiritual answer is, you're just fine? Whether you believe in God or not, just for a moment, humor me. Imagine that for a moment, some sacred being or force is sitting with you. That being knows more than you know, is more patient and loving than you are, and has deep, deep wisdom. And imagine you hear or understand these words coming from that being. Sure, there's room for growth and learning. But you're just fine the way you are. You are just fine with your addiction, your lies, your mean words, your fears, your anxiety, your depression, your delusions, your hoarding, your tears, your aches and pains, your limitations. You're just fine. What would it be like to hear those powerful words and believe them? Last summer, I was at a workshop at a week-long conference. I very carefully picked the workshop that was not the singing workshop. Because if any of you have ever noticed but have been too kind to tell me, I cannot sing. Some really good musicians were leading the singing workshop, and I did not want to spend a week with them having to listen to my way less than adequate voice and my having to listen to their way more than adequate voice and live with that comparison. Guess what? My non-musical workshop got combined with theirs. And when we got to introductions and I explained that I could not sing, the leader, in all graciousness, said, "Don't worry, we can fix that." And without thinking, I said to this nationally known musician, "I'm not broken." It sort of popped out of my mouth. I did not mean to be impertinent in any way, shape, or form, but that little interchange brought home to me how often, when we cannot do something or somebody else cannot do something, we see ourselves as inadequate or in need of fixing. What gets you up in the morning is not about what needs fixing, but is about the search for meaning. What is so compelling in your life that that you cannot help do it. Maybe you're in a job that you don't like, but that job provides money for you to support your family. And that's what gives you meaning. And so you cannot help keep from doing it. Perhaps it's something creative like art or a particular relationship, or you just have to run or walk, or you just have to sit by yourself. When the question is, what is it that you cannot help but do? What is it that you are drawn to? The answers that are possible just open up. So I'm going to make a suggestion for you for this week. Take 10 minutes at the beginning of your day, or perhaps at bedtime the night before, to identify one thing you want out of the coming day. One thing that you want, not your boss wants, not your kids want, not the dog. One thing that you want. In the midst of all the obligations ahead of you, what one desire do you want to make room for? And keep it simple. Maybe it's nothing more than to feel the sun on your face for 5 minutes. Maybe it is to connect and cook tonight's meal with your child or partner or friend. Maybe it is to read or run or just have a few moments of silence. The choice is yours. In a world without end, may this be so.